This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
To connect with Community Waikato on Free FM 89.0. Holly Snape here from Community Waikato. And Harvey Brooks with me again today from Wellbeing Waikato. Great to have you here again. We're talking today about population and data. And don't turn off, you know, because this is actually much more interesting than what you realise. And data is really powerful when it comes to understanding population, how that might feed into the decisions we make in communities. Thank you for joining me, Harvey. Let's start just with a bit of contexting so we all know we're on the same page when we're talking about population.
Absolutely. Kia ora, Holly. I think it's really important to understand, yeah, we all talk about the headline number.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah,
so we all roughly know there's 5 million people in New Zealand. We might all know that there's about 8 billion people in the world.
Yeah. Although I have heard there may be some underestimation up to 25% on that.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. But if we just sort of say yes. It's never precise because we can't count them all.
Yeah.
But I think what's really, really important is to understand, well, where does that number come from?
Yeah.
And what drives that number? Because it's always changing and it always will. And I think last time we talked, I might have said, you know, I think there's a human tendency to look at data like this and just project it forward in a straight line.
Yeah, yeah.
As if the world's a petri dish.
Yeah.
Petri dish. And in terms of population, that is definitely not true. So this is important not only for us in terms of our society as it is today, but definitely for our kids and our grandkids' society, because it's going to change dramatically.
Yeah. Well, tell me a bit about what we mean when we're talking population and what are some of the conditions around that.
Yeah, yeah. So obviously, in the simplest sense, we're simply talking about the count of people.
Yes.
But I think what we've got to talk about is how does that count come about? What drives it? And there are three really basic things, and those are all changing all the time. And so the first one is what's called the fertility rate, which is kind of how it sounds. It's how many kids people have. And in order for a population to stay stable, the fertility rate of a population has to be 2.1.
Yes.
In other words, for every two people, usually a male and a female, they have to produce 2.1 children.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you can't produce 0.1 of a child. So let's say for every 20 parents, there has to be 21 children.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because of mortality during birth.
And of course, that number 2.1 has dropped. Like it was even within my lifetime, it was 2.4. So it says something about mortality rate. It's actually gone down, which means that replacement rate is lower now than it has been historically, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is simply the number in order to replace the population.
In New Zealand?
No, worldwide. That's a simple
number. Oh, that's a simple worldwide number.
Yeah,
so there you go.
We need to just get clear.
Yeah.
This is the fertility rate to keep the population steady. It's not the actual rate right now. So child mortality, and of course the other interesting thing is that if you look at the greatest life, in terms of your life course, when are you at greatest risk of dying, it's actually between the ages of about 14 and 24.
Wow.
And that's because that's the highest risk-taking age.
Yeah.
And just as an example, I saw a great statistic yesterday on the road toll in New Zealand and how that's changed since the 1970s. The worst road toll in New Zealand was 1973, when something like 800 people died on our roads.
Wow.
Now, of course, our population then was probably barely 3 million.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at that population of sort of 14 to 16 to 24-year-olds, their road toll has dropped by two-thirds in that time. So obviously their appetite for risk-taking has reduced enormously, which is a great, great thing. So the fertility rate is important and If you look at the fertility rate in New Zealand, about 50 years ago it was 4,
mm-hmm.
And now it's about 1.7.
Yeah.
So we are not replacing ourselves.
Yes.
So that's factor number one. Factor number two is life expectancy,
mm-hmm.
And that's going in a good direction. So in about the 1940s, the average life expectancy average in New Zealand was about, I think, 48. Now, that's because there was a high child mortality rate.
Mm.
But now it's in the high 70s, low 80s,
mm-hmm.
And so we're all living a lot longer. So those two things are kind of pulling up in opposite directions. You've got far, far fewer children being born and far, far more old people living much, much longer.
Yeah.
So our population is aging. And then the third factor is, of course, migration. How many people are coming in. And then we're sort of talking permanent long-term migration is the real thing, not how many people are kind of flowing in and out every month, but how many people are staying. When you take all those things together, the net result of that is your population. And that's interesting. As I said, those factors are actually changing not only in New Zealand but around the world dramatically.
Yeah, and isn't that interesting? Because I'm going to get a little bit political here now.
Yeah.
It is interesting because of the way that migration is often talked about in quite a negative way.
Well,
it's necessary, right, for us to be able to maintain a population.
Well, it absolutely is. And, of course, you know, it's a truism, but we're all migrants. And you know, it's a normal human thing, I think, to feel like hopefully you're the last person in because it kind of feels all right, you know.
If you're in a
community, you like to feel that too. Not always. But I think, you know, what's interesting about migration in New Zealand is that we absolutely rely on it.
Yeah.
And because that fertility rate is now so low, it's the only game in town. And there's the graph that we might share online after this is that Treasury have actually done the numbers on this and on Treasury, I believe Treasury, and they've said, well, let's just model if migration to New Zealand stopped and we relied entirely on natural increase. So what would happen, let's just say you stop it in 2050. So the population sort of peaks at around about 6 million.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you start running the clock forward, by around about the year 3000, which I know sounds a long time away, but you know,
mm-hmm.
time keeps on ticking. Do you want to have a guess at what the population of New Zealand becomes if there's no migration at all?
Are we at zero?
Zero.
Wow.
Zero.
Yeah, wow.
Because it's just the inevitable negative compounding effect of fewer and fewer babies being born. And the same math applies around the world. And so even though I think, you know, it's seductive to think that there are countries where people are still having enormous numbers of babies. The number of those countries is getting fewer and fewer. So fertility rates, I mean, we all know places like Japan where it's, you know, really, really low. But even places like Asia, India, their fertility rates close to or below two, except in the counting point that you pointed out. In places like Africa, it's getting down pretty low as well. And so that will compound over time. And so there's a really, really good book called Empty Planet, which is about 5 years old, and I'll get you the names of the authors in just a sec. Daryl Bricker and John Ibbotson. So it's called Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. And they've pointed out that the rate of population decline in the world, I'm talking about the rate, not the actual absolute number, is far, far greater than people thought. And so they literally think that in the next few hundred years, the biggest problem for humanity is not going to be too many of us, it's going to be too few of us.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating for New Zealand, because if Treasury and these guys and others are right, then that means that what's New Zealand's strategy going to be? It certainly can't be this kind of too many migrants narrative, because there won't be anyone else. And so we've really got to think hard about, we are the most isolated, one of the smallest countries in the world. And if every country in the world is now competing furiously for people, why would they come here? And so the narrative will change. And this is the future for our kids and our grandkids.
Yeah, it is really interesting, and especially if we have a country that appears to have hostility towards migrants, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as I said, you know, it's old politics.
Yes, it is. But it's politics that's working well internationally. Like when we look at what's happening in places like the United States, but also going back just a few years to the Brexit, you know, conversations, that this is politics that resonates very strongly with large populations of people.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a deep, deep primal element to it, the fear of difference.
Yeah.
And we're off the data here in a way, but I think the real issue always with migration is not necessarily the migration, it's the rate of change. We're both old enough, Holly, if I can say that, to remember, you know, the shrieks and cries in the 90s of the Asian invasion.
Yeah. I don't remember. No, I don't. I do. I am old enough.
and you don't hear that anymore.
No.
You know, you hear some political parties at the moment saying some extraordinarily unkind things about migration from Southeast Asia and places like that in India.
Yes.
And I think it's the rate of change that's the thing. And, of course, it stokes fear in community, because when communities feel that things are changing to the point where they don't think they recognise it anymore, then they become activated and motivated, which is really unfortunate. So I think the greatest responsibility a government can have is to carefully manage the rate of change, not necessarily the change.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, with this in mind, and I think it was fascinating thinking about how critical migration is to stabilise population.
Yeah.
It indicates clearly that we using population data really supports robust decision making when it comes to policies, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit further about how we could see that and how we could use data?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and look, I'm not a fanboy of the Treasury at all, but they do some pretty good work, and they're actually doing this work right now. So when you hear politicians arguing about things like the superannuation age, they are actually responding to this data. You play this forward. So if there are many, many more retired people than there are working age people in the future, and I think the statistic is about 10 years ago there was 7 people for every retired person.
Yes.
And in the next 15 or 20 years there's going to be 2 working people for every retired person. And so you get to this point where we're not generating enough money to look after our retired people. And so this drives some really, really tough, difficult conversations about how we fund things like retirement, how we tax, but I think also how we look at ourselves as a society and how we treat people beyond a certain chronological number. I think in times gone past, there's a sort of, you're retired, you've checked out, you can sit in your rocking chair and look out on from the veranda. But
And often for your last 5 years, right?
Well,
but
exactly
now
right.
We're talking 25, 30 years potentially.
That's a great point. So, 50 years ago, statistically, because remember, it wasn't until the mid-90s that the retirement age went up from 60 to 65. So 50 years ago, statistically, you might have only been retired for about 8 years.
Yeah.
But now you might be retired for 20 or 30.
Yeah.
And so that's a big, big draw on the New Zealand tax system if we continue the way we are, not to mention the health system.
Yeah. Well, especially when politicians are competing about reducing taxes rather than increasing taxes.
Yeah.
You know, so and it feels like tweaking it by raising it to 67 doesn't resolve the problem, right?
Well, if you see that as the end game, that probably it doesn't.
Yeah.
Hopefully, it's the start of a conversation about a progressive change.
Yes.
And age is one thing.
Yeah, that's right. I do wonder about some people's bodies burn out quicker than others, and depending on the work we do too, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I've thought about this a bit too, because I think it's a fair claim to say, look, if you're working in a freezing works for 30 years, you're shot. You're done.
Yeah.
And you might be done at 55.
Yeah.
Not 60, and certainly not 60, 65 or 70. And I'll just throw this out there. I actually think we have a solution to that in front of us right now. We have an ACC system.
That's right.
And the ACC system, let's accept that it's objective just for a second, objectively assesses people's physical capacity to work and then makes a judgment, no, you can't work, therefore the state will actually subsidise you for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
So I think we've got a system in place where you could say, for example, that everybody is eligible at the age of 65 to either opt opt out of super for a period of time, maybe 5 years or whatever it is, or if you think that actually you, your physical state or your mental state or whatever means that you actually are physically no longer capable to work, then you have an assessment system like ACC, and there would be an appeal process for that, which you are able to go through, and they say, yep, yep, you know, you're a good freezing worker, you're a good road worker, you're a shot mate, you now are, you qualify for super. Yeah. You know, why not?
We also know data shows us that certain ethnic groups, you know, were end up dying younger.
Yes, that's right.
and often are clustered in more laborious jobs.
Yes.
So their bodies may wear out earlier as well. So, you know, that, and these are really hard conversations too, because who wants to talk about, you know, what the data is actually showing very clearly when that's it comes to ethnicity.
That's right. And the data shows that at an aggregate level.
Yes.
You know, so statistically, if you're Māori or Pacific, you are statistically more likely to die at a younger age. Of course, what that means for the individual will vary tremendously.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, yeah, my punt would be, just like accidents happen to individuals, not to populations, I think we can look at this in a way which respects the individual and gives some degree of agency to the individual to decide what's best for them in terms of their life course and their circumstances.
There was data just a few years ago, it's still valid data that tells us that, for example, Māori present with bowel cancer earlier.
Yeah.
And so that drove a whole lot of new legislation around testing.
Screening.
Yeah, for Māori younger, which saved lives. Yeah. And of course, this has been sort of overturned. And I think this is a really interesting and powerful use of data, but it's contentious, right?
Well, it is, because it's the straight line projection thing.
Yes.
What are we saying, that all Māori have bowel cancer?
Of course, that's fallacious reasoning, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, I'd see that as a good example of social investment.
Yes,
where we're saying statistically, it's more likely that this and this and this. So, it's worth investing with a population.
Yeah.
Because the probabilities are that by doing that, society will get a better long term payment than if it didn't.
Yeah.
It'll mean that some people, of course, are tested who will never present.
Yeah.
But that's true.
And
now,
it will also mean some non-Māori will develop bowel cancer early, not be screened,
and
will die.
Right. And that may be true as well. And that's the difficult ethical dilemma.
Right. It's the same actually as breast cancer. Men can get breast cancer. Well, it's just rare.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it always fascinates me, Holly, that biologically men are differentiated females. That's why we have breasts, we have nipples.
Absolutely. So I mean, of course, if we want to then say we'll screen everyone, men and women, we actually need, if we want to screen everybody at an earlier age, we need to increase our tax.
We need to fund that differently.
That's
exactly right. And so that's it.
It's a whole conversation.
It's a huge conversation about universalism versus targeting.
Yes.
And by doing that, that's why I mentioned social investment, because social investment does lean a bit more towards targeting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for some things, universalism is cost effective, because the cost of trying to target fiscally and socially is just too high.
Yeah. Tell me any more, have you got other examples of any specific data that relates to New Zealand that gives us an interesting story?
About population?
Yeah.
Well, I think, we're sitting in Hamilton, and I think most people understand that we're in the Upper North Island, and so 50% of New Zealand's population already lives above Taupō. And that will only continue to increase.
And that has been, if we look over the history of New Zealand, actually, the migration north has kind of been a pattern, forever, really, and since colonisation.
Yes, it has. I mean, there's been isolated exceptions to that. And, it always intrigues me, if I could give you a fascinating fact or two, that I think in the late 19th century, the biggest city in New Zealand was Dunedin. Because of gold mining.
Oh, yes.
And so if you came to New Zealand looking for opportunity, you would probably head south, and you almost can't go much further south. And the funny fact about that is that at the same time, can you guess the second biggest city in New Zealand?
Waihi? I'm just going off gold mining.
You had it. It was Thames.
Wow. Yeah. Would not have picked that, though, eh?
No. You know? Can you imagine living in Thames? And, of course, city, by definition, 20,000 people. Yeah. It's a funny definition. Because of gold mining. And so when the gold ran out in Thames, I think they all headed to central Otago.
Mm-hmm.
And Thames then went through a long, slow decline.
Yeah.
And it probably has stopped declining now, thanks to that aging population process that we were talking about. But I think that's the fascinating thing, and one of the things I often think about is no human settlement is permanent.
Mm.
None. They just rise and decline at different rates and different speeds.
Mm.
And that's okay in a sense, because if people and assets and capital are moving somewhere else because more can be done with it somewhere else, that's fine, but it's the rate of change, which is the issue. So if you took, for example, and apologies to all my friends in Tokoroa, you might say that it's a town in decline because of the withdrawal of industries and that kind of thing.
Mm.
Let's just say that those industries have gone somewhere where they can do the same thing better. Fine. But the people are left behind.
Yeah.
And so it's the social cost of change which is the real issue. So, you know, Shamabil Yacob talks about zombie towns.
Yes.
And paradoxically, a few of his zombie towns have turned out not to be because of the deurbanisation, which is often happening, especially out of Auckland. So populations are spilling out of Auckland all the time. But he's right as well. And for me, it's not a case of trying to stop the change, because I just think you're kind of trying to be Canute when you do that. But it's about saying, how can we reinvigorate these communities to be something and do something different?
And I imagine, you know, by using these data sets, how can we predict these things as they're happening and then put in place what might help mitigate social harm, social decline?
Exactly right. So, you know, looking at the aggregate population and the aggregate population of a community, but then also splitting it, say, by age and by ethnicity to say, well, who is actually here? Because when you get if you get a community where there's a high percentage of youth but low unemployment, you've got something to worry about.
Yeah.
And so thinking carefully about that and thinking, well, what might our strategies be from an economic and a social development point of view to mitigate the risk that there might be and maximise the opportunity? Because what you've got there is a whole lot of latent talent.
Yeah,
which wants to do something.
We're in Hamilton City as we speak right now. Fastest growing city in New Zealand.
Yeah, it is apparently.
Yeah. And has been for a little while.
Has been.
And we've traditionally had a lower population average age.
Yeah.
Probably because of university.
Because of university, I think also because of the population dynamics. I mean, it's got a relatively high Māori population percentage, and Māori tend to have a lower median age than the rest of New Zealand. Its Pacific population is rising quite fast. These are good things, but they are a relatively young population as well. And then also, Hamilton's curious. It always makes me laugh when it's described as close to everything else, but it's kind of true.
Yeah.
Hamilton's the closest city geographically to Auckland.
Yes.
And so in a economic sense, it is actually a sort of an outer boundary suburb of Auckland. Apologies. And what that means is that if you're in Auckland and you're a business and let's say land values are just too high, or you're finding that you can't your workers can't afford to live in $1.3 million houses anymore, then the rational move is south.
Yeah.
To Hamilton, especially now because of the expressway. And so you see things like Sleepyhead or Heneway. You see a lot of the businesses that have gone to the Ruakura hub. All other things being equal, they would have been in Auckland.
Yeah.
But the math works for them here because it's only an hour south or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, from a wellbeing Waikato perspective in the last sort of 3 minutes we have, you know, what does this mean? Like you've got all these insights around population data and you're an insights organisation really around wellbeing.
Yes.
Talk me through that.
Well, I mean, if I can sort of talk about it in a really sort of analytical way, What I think it says, especially to our local government organisations and central government, is who are you building the infrastructure for? Because most infrastructure is long-lived. It might be 50 years, it might be 100 years. And there's certainly a demand for this stuff right now, but we've got to build it in a way that if things change dramatically in the future, either compositionally or aggregately, that we have the ability to adapt and we don't have stranded assets. Now, for the reasons that we've talked about, I think there's a pretty low chance that Hamilton is going to be a zombie town, very low chance.
Yeah.
I don't think there's going to be much of that. But some of the smaller communities around the Waikato might find themselves struggling to attract people. And so for councils, it's and they'll be doing this all the time because they run their own population models. But they'll be thinking, yes, there's a demand to have a facility of a certain sort right now. Will the demand still be there in 20, 30, 40, 50 years' time? Because that's the life of the asset, and our ratepayers are going to start paying for it in day one. And thinking carefully about what's the trajectory for our population, and are we actually building the community for them that will be them in the next 50 years? Maybe, maybe not. There's risk in all of this because we could be 100% wrong.
And you think that the councils will be considering this as they're having these conversations about the future of local government?
Well, I would rather they have those conversations than actually talk about the future of local government because, quite frankly, crayon lines on a piece of paper makes no difference.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Yeah. I mean, very, very true. So Wellbeing Waikato, what are you going to do with this data and this information?
Yeah, well, a lot of what we've talked about today is one of the chapters in our report, State of the Region Report. And so what we do is amplify that information such as we're doing today so that more people are sensitized to it and aware of it. And it puts them in a better position as citizens to make the best decisions that they can make about themselves, their whānau, their community, their district, wherever. So, we don't have any power as it is to do anything about these things except to empower people with that knowledge so that when they hear someone say, oh, well, you know, this is happening or that's happening, maybe they can say, well, are you sure?
Yeah, very true. If people want to access the report, how do they go about that?
Go to our website, wellbeingwaikato.org.nz, look under the reports tab and the State of the Region report is there.
And how often will a State of the Region report come out?
Annually.
Wow, that's a bit of work, Harvey.
Well, I've got to keep myself busy during summer.
It is important work, though, too. It is really critical because it does drive good decision-making, right?
Oh, absolutely. And look, Holly, New Zealand Initiative just released a kind of a State of New Zealand report yesterday, and I read it last night and I thought, we've already done this.
Yeah.
Which is really good.
Yeah, nice to be ahead of the ball, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, no, that is fantastic. This has been fascinating.
Great.
Harvey's going to be joining us regularly to have conversations about the work that they're doing and the insights that they're gaining. So if you have questions, you can always message either Harvey or myself and ask questions and we will explore that in detail.
Yeah, let us know what you want to hear us talk about.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us. You have been listening to Connect with Community Waikato Free FM 89.0.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.